Welcome back to Midpoint, my friends. Today is April 29th, 2026, and I'm your host, Shelley Reback. Today's show is going to cover another timely topic, baby making, reproduction, especially assisted reproduction. It's an issue that has been freakishly focused on by so many conservative politicians who seem to want to control every aspect of it. It's also an issue explored in a very entertaining way in the recent award-winning documentary film, Dad Genes, which will have its Tampa Bay area premiere in St. Pete at the Sunscreen Film Festival on Saturday, May 2nd. Matt Isaac, the producer of Dad Genes, is with us remotely to discuss the film and all of the issues it raised by anonymous sperm donation. Like, is it really anonymous anymore? What is a family? And are children the product of nature or nurture? And because, as we know, the personal is always political, also with us is attorney Roya Barrios, whose law practice specializes in the legal and ethical considerations surrounding assisted reproduction. There's no one better positioned to join us to talk about the issues raised by this film than Roya, since she's also a film buff and the president of the board of the Gasparilla Film Festival. We'll be hearing both guests and discussing our topic in a few minutes, right after our news nuggets of the week. Well, the Florida legislature has opened its special session this week to finally pass a state budget, as they are required to do by the Florida Constitution. Naturally, Governor DeSantis has taken this opportunity for extended legislative action by also proposing more ways to unconstitutionally advance his MAGA-like agenda. Yesterday, following the redistricting efforts in California and Virginia that ended up increasing the likelihood of putting more Democrats in Congress, DeSantis released his own proposed mid-decade congressional redistricting maps that would possibly result in Florida supplying Congress with an additional 4 Republican seats that could protect the Trump regime and its U.S. House majority in the midterm elections. Or maybe not. Experts seem to think that any attempt to redistrict Florida in today's political climate could backfire and result in the Democrats actually picking up more seats rather than Republicans. Either way, the redistricting attempt is almost certainly unconstitutional under the Florida Fair Districts Amendment to the Florida Constitution. Florida's Constitution bans partisan gerrymandering specifically, but DeSantis' office is arguing against that requirement. And either side will sue over the result if the redistricting goes forward. Yet, as of last evening, the Florida House leadership appears to be backing DeSantis' argument that his proposed congressional map doesn't need to follow the state's constitutional ban on partisan gerrymandering. The Tampa Bay Times reports that DeSantis' office, in a legal memo sent to lawmakers, laid out a plan to dismantle Florida's Fair Districts Amendment, a voter-adopted ban on drawing maps to favor a political party. The memo, sent out by General Counsel David Axelman, implied the governor's office doesn't need to follow the Fair Districts law as a whole, because the office believes part of it, related to race and redistricting, is unconstitutional. In a legal stretch and a reach that Gumby would be proud of, the administration takes the position that the race requirements in the redistricting map presented by DeSantis and passed by the legislature back in 2022 cannot be severed from the rest of the requirements, also known as the ban on partisan gerrymandering. And therefore, they claim, the Fair Districts Law is itself unconstitutional and the last maps will need to be replaced. House Speaker Daniel Perez, who has worked over the past 2 years to assert the House is an independent body from DeSantis, told lawmakers on Tuesday that, nonetheless, he plans to put the governor's proposal to a vote today, Wednesday. That's not surprising, since neither the House nor the Senate put forward its own map. The governor's map would actually split Tampa three ways. Should the redistricting go forward, and if the Republicans succeed in passing it, that would leave the entire Tampa Bay region with absolutely no Democratic representation in Congress at all. We'll know soon. Two other key priorities of Governor DeSantis that failed to advance in the regular legislative session were tossed out in the special session yesterday. The Florida House remains fairly clear in its position against the proposals to expand vaccine exemptions for public kindergarten through grade 12 students and to protect consumers' interactions with artificial intelligence. DeSantis was quick to criticize the House, posting on X, formerly Twitter, that, quote, voters elected Republicans to protect freedom against both the big tech cartel and the medical industrial complex. In his petulant way, DeSantis posted, quote, will be interesting to see these guys campaign as big tech enthusiasts and guardians of the medical industrial complex. Close quote. The Florida Senate still seemed to support the governor's bills, particularly the vaccine exemption bill. The sole opponent in the Senate, Senator Aaron Grail of Vero Beach, said that the advertising around the bill, which was retweeted in the morning by DeSantis, painted those opposing the measure as, quote, somehow a Jeffrey Epstein sympathizer. Now, regarding the AI bill, House Speaker Perez maintained that the federal government should handle that issue, and he anticipates that Congress will address it soon. But DeSantis doesn't want to wait. The push for legislation in Florida has expanded following a still unfolding criminal investigation into OpenAI over its chatbot's interactions with the alleged gunman in last year's Florida State University mass shooting. State officials say that that shooter exchanged messages with ChatGPT in the minutes before the attack. The proposed AI bill would create a new section of Florida law establishing a set of defined rights for residents interacting with AI, including the right to know when they are communicating with a machine, the right to control their children's use of AI, and the right to know when companies are collecting personal or biometric data. Parents would gain sweeping control over so-called companion chatbots, defined as systems designed to simulate human relationships. The bill also extends into schools and government contracting, limiting how AI tools can be used in classrooms. It remains to be seen if DeSantis can get this bill over the finish line in this special session. So far, it seems doubtful. All right, on to our topic of the day. What makes a family? The new documentary, Dad Genes, captures a profound life transition. As Aaron Long loses his aging mother, previously his only close family, he simultaneously gains an entirely new, unconventional family, born from some decades-old sperm donations. What begins as a DNA test revelation becomes an unprecedented experiment in instant fatherhood, a surprising romance with the mother of one of his donor children, worldwide media attention, and an unforeseen journey into viral celebrity. Through Aaron's story, this film explores how modern technology enables new connections between people and how families are being redefined in unexpected ways. This entertaining, emotionally rich documentary offers a fresh perspective on 21st century parenthood, the nature versus nurture debate, and what happens when private lives become public spectacle. The press for this film suggests that Dad Genes, the film, will spark conversations about atypical families, the role of technology in contemporary life, and the unexpected ways that we find belonging. So let's get into these very conversations with my guests. Matt Isaac is the producer of Dad Genes, and he's joining us remotely. His film, Dad Jeans, will have its local premiere at the Sunscreen Film Festival in St. Pete on Saturday, May 2nd. So welcome to Midpoint, Matt.
Good morning, Shelley. Thank you so much for having me on. It's really great to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you. And Roya Barrios is joining us in the WMNF studios. Roya is an attorney whose law practice specializes in relationships conceived with assisted reproductive technology. See what I did there, Roya? She is also the president of the board of the Gasparilla Film Festival in Tampa. So welcome back to WMNF, Roya.
Thank you so much for having me, Shelley.
Let's get into the film itself. Jessica, please play the trailer.
Back in 1994, I was between things in my lives. I didn't know what I was doing. At some point, I just saw an ad in the student newspaper. It saw your sperm. I really just did it for the money. Now I have 67 children. Oh. There was no expectation in my mind that I would ever meet my progeny.
Anonymous meant anonymous. Now, anonymous is really not so much anonymous anymore.
Started thinking, I don't want to know more about my dad, what my other half of my family tree is.
It's weird just not knowing.
There were some things that I missed out on. Like, I have never played a game of baseball in my life.
You're doing great, son.
It's going to be an interesting visit for everybody concerned.
Are you guys looking for a father figure? I definitely thought, how cool would it be if I got together with the mother of my daughter?
I could see Annie just dating. I mean, like, it would be like a natural progression because, like, they already have a kid together.
He's got some good genes, I have to say.
All right, so that's the trailer for the film, and I mean, we're radio, so all you get is the audio, but I encourage you to go find the trailer online and look at it. One of the interesting things is to look at that there are like three children who are focused on in the film itself. Look at them and look at Aaron and see, do they resemble each other? I mean, that's one of the things that the kids themselves were very interested in finding out. And one of the reasons they wanted to meet their, I want to say father, but really their sperm donor, to see how much of him is in them. Let's like review the facts first. So Matt, am I correct that we find out that Aaron may have something over 60 biological children just from his sperm donations? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. He, you know, Aaron had been, he'd been a donor in the 1990s, and we meet him more than 20 years later, and he's living a very unconventional, untraditional life. He's living in downtown Seattle in an artist co-op. He'd never been married, never raised a family, and he had mostly put this out of his mind. But he goes on 23andMe and immediately gets connected to a biological son. And in their messages that they exchange, the son calls him dad immediately in the first message. And that son has already connected to some of his half-siblings. And Aaron suddenly learns that he has many children. And his own math speculates that he has over 60 children, but we really don't know. He's aware of 22. He thinks there may be over 60, but there could actually be hundreds out there. You know, we really aren't sure.
But he's aware of 22.
He knows for sure that he has 22. Those are 22 that he's connected with in some way. He's met some of them, and he's connected with some of them online.
Wow. But
it really depends upon who's on 23andMe and who's out there looking for a connection.
And there's also, he found his son, Bryce, who's one of the focal children in the film, because Bryce registered with a donor sperm registry, right? So Roya,
The donor sibling registry.
Yeah, the donor sibling registry, so that kids who are born, who know that they're born from donor sperm, can register with this online registry. And it's kind of like 23andMe. They can find their donor, if the donor registers, and other siblings.
So when they purchase sperm, they'll get a donor ID number. So the donor can put in the sperm donor, the egg donor's donor number, And then it will connect half siblings through that identifying number.
Wow. So, all right. Well, Matt, let me ask you, what brought you to this story of Aaron and his maybe 60-something children?
Yeah, I knew Aaron. And Aaron,
you knew him personally?
I knew him, and I'm from New York City, and I was spending some time in Seattle. And at Aaron's building, there was a lot of musicians and artists who lived there, and they would occasionally have talent shows. And I attended one of their talent shows. It was like a party, and usually people would sing a new song or maybe do a magic trick. At the one that I attended, Aaron, as his talent that he presented, he gave a PowerPoint presentation about his talent of being a sperm donor when he was younger.
Oh, wow.
And it was very funny. And he, at that point, that was his way of telling his friends and the people that he knew that he had connected with some of these kids online, but he hadn't met them yet. And I said to him, you know, I would love to, you know, I have a background working on film projects. I would love to film this and to see what it's like. And I think when I worked with the director, Craig Downing, and initially we thought that perhaps when they came together, Aaron organized a party in Seattle.
And that party is in the film. There's a party where three of Aaron's kids, or I don't know, should we call them his kids, progeny, three of Aaron's progeny come to meet him in Seattle. And he throws this big party to introduce them to all his friends. And I just wonder, like, we don't really know how the kids felt about being put on display like that. And I just wonder, were they comfortable with it? It's hard to tell from the film.
All the kids who went to the party initially, they went in knowing that they were going to be at the party and knowing we were going to film them, of course. We actually interviewed them all before they went to that party just to see what their anticipation was of meeting their sperm donor father. I think we initially thought that maybe this would just be an interesting weekend, you know, that they would meet each other and then they would all go home. And that would be it. You know, maybe it would be even a short film. But what we were seeing develop almost immediately is the connections that they were having, that the kids started to form bonds with each other, and they started to form connections with Aaron, and Aaron started to care for them. And that grew in, that became a much longer story. And within about a year, two of his kids move into his building in Seattle. One moves across the country to be there with him.
Yeah. Now, also, there's a lot in that year. There's tons of publicity. I don't know whether you had anything to do with that in promoting this story, or Aaron himself had anything to do with it, or he got a publicist or what. But I mean, his story was featured in the New York Times Modern Love column, and it was read by Cale Penn on their Modern Love podcast. And there were tons of articles in all kinds of publications nationally and internationally. And again, I wonder, like, how did the kids feel about, you know, being on display like that, or being, you know, sort of the subject of what turned into this huge media event?
I think that and this was something that when two of his kids move in, and it's the one is a teenager and it's the mom of one, and around that same time, Aaron's elderly mother also moves into his building. So suddenly he goes from being a single guy to having three generations living under one roof. And it was so extraordinary that Aaron himself wrote about it in the New York Times. He wrote that article, and that led to a lot of other attention. And, you know, initially they were very excited about that, you know, and you know, they did a lot of appeal. They were on Good Morning America because their circumstances were so unique. And I think it was something that was very exciting to them to do. And you could see it in the film. You know, at one point, Aaron Aaron gets an agent. You know, he's because his story is so unique, and they're talking about making a, you know,
Yeah, he
interested in
talks
making
about making
feature
a
film.
feature, that somebody's interested in making a feature film of this story, which, you know, I can see it. I can see a feature film of this story, you know, somewhat fictionalized. It's a really compelling story. So, I mean, it for me, why do you think it got so much attention, Matt?
I think that because it's such an extraordinary circumstances that really just comes about with the advent of the DNA testing. I
Right.
mean, that really makes the story. And it's something that Aaron's experiences are extremely unique. And there are other sperm donors out there who are connecting with kids, but the connections that Aaron makes in this new family that he creates, that's what's very unique. But a lot of people are discovering other things about their families on 23andMe. And I think that's the thing that gives it this sort of universal resonance. And during the course of making this film, and you know, we're going around to film festivals now and talking to people, so many people have come up to me and said, you know, I've discovered a half sibling I didn't know.
Right.
I discovered that who I thought was my father isn't my father. You know, it's
Right,
another
right.
man. And I think more and more people are discovering, making those discoveries about their families, and these things that once were secrets or once could be hidden just can't be hidden anymore.
Right. I've been
And
doing this show for like 9 years now, and early on, I did a show about DNA, about 23andMe, and one of my friends was actually abandoned as a baby right after birth. She was found by a police officer and then adopted into the police officer's family. And she never knew anything about her origins until she decided to do a 23andMe test and found out her, you know, she had a biological family, found out her ethnicity, which had always been a mystery. And, you know, other friends of mine have found, like you said, half siblings. They found their fathers were not really their fathers. It really is a whole new world. Hey, listeners, this is Midpoint on WMNF Radio. We're talking about families, how they're created, if they're created with assisted reproduction, like sperm donation. And we're talking about the film Dad Genes that is going to be premiered in the Tampa Bay area on Saturday in St. Pete at the Sunscreen Film Festival. If you've got some thoughts about any of this, you can give us a call at 813-333 813 239-9663. You can email us at dj@wmnf.org, or you can text us at 813-433-0885. What do you think the story says about what is a family? It seems like Aaron, whose life was pretty quiet and very limited before his foray into 23andMe, he doesn't immediately become a father. His life doesn't instantly pivot from, you know, kind of lonely guy to fulfillment. It becomes like a lot messier, more crowded with people, more uncertain. But it's true, I think, Matt, that there are some real emotional bonds that he develops with at least those three children that we meet in your film. And those three children seem to be happy to learn more about, like, where their nose came from or their artistic sensibilities came from. They seem, you know, very much satisfied to have that information.
So I kind of wanted to say that I think it's a testament to how the mothers were in this, that there wasn't deception. They weren't surprised. They didn't feel like there was, you know, that there was anything missing. They just had more information to learn. They weren't looking for a father figure. They were satisfied in their own lives. And I think that that's an important takeaway from it too. I know we're focusing a lot on Aaron because this is Aaron's story, but I think that we also need to reflect on how good the parents were, the mothers were, in raising their children, that that they weren't looking for something that was missing, that Aaron was just a bonus to them in their lives.
Well, yeah, first and foremost, the children were informed that they were the product of sperm donation. They weren't, you know, deceived about that in any way. And it seems like, you know, the mothers in the film were lesbian couples, although I'm not so sure about Jess. That's sort of unclear, you know, that's not really made clear in the film. The woman that Aaron then becomes, you know, have an intimate romantic relationship with, I'm not sure what her status was at the time that she had the sperm donation. But the other mothers are part of lesbian couples. And, you know, maybe I'm a mother, maybe it's because I'm a mother, but I thought the different responses of the mothers of Aaron's children in the film was really so interesting. Their feelings about the situation were really so different from each other. It was clear that at least two of them had some strong feelings about the situation. I think, like Maddie's mother, the teenager who moves cross country to live with Aaron, but one of Maddie's mothers, Amber, seemed to really resent the discovery of Aaron, and she seemed to really resent her daughter's interest in him. I wonder if she was really so upset about Aaron entering their lives, or that Maddie, her daughter, was given a reason to leave home and move away to get to know her father, because that seemed like a source of conflict in that family. I mean, every mother has mixed feelings when their kid leaves home. And I wonder if Amber really resented Aaron or Maddie's decision to leave more. That was one question I had. And her partner, Tina, also Maddie's mother, seemed much more accepting of the situation and open to it. And then there was also the mother of Aaron's son, Bryce. She seems grateful that her son finally has a male father figure to identify with. It seems like he kind of longed for that his whole life. So it's interesting. I mean, we don't really, all the women seem to have been in lesbian relationships, except, like I say, we don't really know what the case was with Jess, Alice's mother, because, whoa, you know, unexpected plot twist there. Tell us about Jess and Aaron, Matt.
Yeah, and I think it's important. I think it was important for us to show the different ways that the children related to Aaron, but also the moms related to Aaron, and show that different those different perspectives. And you know, in many cases, the kids either it's a single mom or it's two moms. And what another interesting part of that is that, you know, Aaron knows for sure about these 22 kids. The more where there's a father figure in the family, the kids are less interested, or the family seems less interested in reaching out to him. You know, that's something that, you know, we learned after we made the film. But it's usually the case if there's two moms or one mom, there's more interest in connecting with Aaron. You know, that's something that Aaron had shared with us. I think it really was important for us to show those different perspectives, because everyone is just sort of figuring this out. It's uncharted territory. And I think the real surprise with Jess was the romantic relationship that developed out of it. And I think that's the only known documented case of a woman later getting into a relationship with her anonymous sperm donor.
Yeah. I know, and I wondered if it was frankly contrived for the film, you know? I mean, I don't know. They seem to be really sincerely close in the way they were filmed. But I don't know. Maybe because I'm a cynical, skeptical person. I just don't know.
Well, I think that, you know, that's a question that other people have brought up as well. And
oh, there's other cynical, you know, skeptical people.
But they are still together. You know, we followed them over several years and they are still together, and their media attention, you know, is no longer what it was. And they've sort of settled down into married life now. And they are living together, and they were raising their daughter, who's now in college. And, you know, Aaron is helping to pay for his daughter's college now, you know, helping to put her through college. So it's been an incredible transformation for them, you know, for both of them. And it's just something that, you know, Aaron describes it in the film as sort of a science fiction circumstances, you know, things that you really just could not conceive of happening, you know, during the time that he started out with this process.
Matt, I have a question for you since you've been following them. Do you know if Aaron has actually adopted his daughter? Because he wouldn't have any rights to her.
I don't believe that that's happened.
Okay.
I don't believe that, that hasn't happened.
Yeah, so as a matter of law, Roya, the sperm donor fathers don't have any legal rights to those children, huh?
No, he would have relinquished all rights to any child that he would have who would be born from that sperm. So technically, he's not a father.
Yeah.
So he would have to, ironically, he would have to adopt his child, his biological child. Yeah.
And that's true in all the jurisdictions, huh?
Yes. And that's in Florida. We have a statute directly on point for sperm donation, egg donation, and embryo donation, that when you have this agreement, then they relinquish all parental rights and the intended parent can't then go after them for rights. Just like Jess wouldn't be able to go after Aaron to pay for college, even though he is paying for it. That would not be a financial obligation of his.
Well, you know, speaking of obligations, I just want to note that Aaron seems to get off pretty lightly in the film and presumably in his real life. I mean, he's got all these hardworking, doting, attentive lesbian mothers raising his children for 20 some years or whatever the age of the kid is. And then in his 50s, he just shows up and immediately becomes like a big centerpiece in their lives. In the lives of these kids. He makes one remark in the film that really struck me at the party that he throws to introduce and show off his kids to his friends. He says, "I think parenting is pretty easy," or something like that. And I know it was meant as a joke, but in fact, for him, it was absolutely true. He did absolutely nothing to raise those kids. It's not co-parenting.
No. And he did nothing to raise them because he's not their parent. So he shouldn't have done anything.
Yeah, but he it's interesting that he's getting the emotional payoff of a relationship with these kids at this point. Well, but I guess that serves the kids' interest too.
Yeah, yeah, and it seems like he's very open to what they're looking for. So there were 18 kids that didn't really pursue a relationship with him, and there's 3 that did. So, you know, it's not like he's imposing himself on their lives, even though they now have each other's identity.
Yeah.
There's no obligations in either direction.
I wonder what one of the questions that was raised by this film is, you know, what about the debate between nature and nurture? Like, you've got all these, you know, lesbian mom parents raising these kids, and then the kids meet their donor father, and, you know, one of them, I guess it's Maddie, who's the teenage girl who moves across country to be with Aaron, seems to think that his genetic profile really influenced her as far as, look at, we have the same nose, we have the same artistic sensibility, that type of thing. I don't know. What do you think about that? Matt, did you have any thoughts about that, having been close to the families?
Well, I do think it's interesting because they obviously, Maddie, and I think that the other kids there are looking for that. They're trying to form that connection and to see those connections with each other. And you know, Aaron asked, do we all have the same color eyes? And they're looking at each other,
right,
at each other's eyes. But you know, beyond the, you know, the sort of physical things, they are looking for all the things that they like. Do they like the same music? Do they fold their arms the same way? They're kind of looking for these connections between people, but we don't answer that necessarily. You know, I think we want to raise those questions and have this to be a point of discussion, you know, like today, you know, where people can really use the film as a way to think about these things and to consider these things. Because there, I don't know if there is an easy answer to any of the questions that are raised by the film. It's a bit complicated, and I think these questions about nature and nurture can be a bit complicated as well.
And also, though, when the intended parents are selecting the donor, they're looking for certain qualities sometimes. So they may want certain height. They may want a certain eye color. They may want them to be good at, like, lean more towards the stems or be more artistic. So
that's
these are
true.
Profiles.
One of the parents discussed that in the film, that she said she was specifically looking for someone who was more artistic and less of a kind of a jock. It's interesting that she's the only one that we meet who had a boy. The other children are girls. She's the only one that we meet who had a boy. And that boy is terrible at sports, has never played any sports. And kind of like, it seems like he kind of like rues that he didn't have the kind of father who could teach him to throw a baseball or something. You know, you're right, Roya, that may be that out of the catalog of sperm donors that the mothers had to choose from, you know, they selected those traits, mm-hmm. right? Wow. Well,
I think what's surprising, too, is that, you know, this is going back to that time period when some of the kids were born, there was so little information about it. It might only be a few words from what they're describing. You know, they don't have pictures of
Right, they don't have pictures. They have like height, weight, ethnicity. Sometimes they have religion. They have these characteristics, like the way the donor describes themselves. Right, Roya?
Yes.
You get like a catalog.
So there. Obviously, it's more updated now than it would have been 20 years ago.
And what's it like now?
Well, it's a different sperm. They're different. So what he did it through a sperm bank. So there's like anonymous donations through a sperm bank where he donates to the bank, and then the bank then essentially sells sperm to the mothers, the intended parent. But you can also do directed sperm donation agreements where you have more information, and it's directly from person to person. And then you can have a little more information that you want, or you can request additional information. So that's just kind of, I would say that most sperm does come through sperm banks, unlike egg donors where they do, it's a lot more direct and you have more information, where women don't just give their eggs to an egg bank, because obviously it's more difficult.
The process of egg retrieval is a lot more invasive and difficult than what men go through to donate their sperm. But I remember reading years ago that there was some specific sperm bank in California that had like genius sperm, and you had to pay thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to use sperm from one of those people, right?
Yeah, but let's remember, people are also self-reporting, right? I mean, that's the problem, is that, you know, it didn't have this turn in this documentary, but sometimes, these sperm donors aren't really what they're saying they are. They're not required to do psychological evaluations. You're not really getting a full medical history from them. There was that case with the sperm donor who had, I think he had schizophrenia, because the donor didn't represent his medical information accurately.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Well, let me ask you, Roya, given your expertise in this legal area, are sperm donors or recipients still allowed to be promised anonymity anymore? I mean, are both sides of the equation allowed to be promised? I mean, there was the one mother who really didn't really want Aaron to be disclosed to her daughter. The people who bought the sperm were probably promised anonymity at that time too, right? And of course, the donor was promised anonymity. Is anonymity even a thing anymore?
So I always tell my clients that anonymity is not a thing. You know, we don't, 10 years ago, we didn't know where we would be with technology today. In 10 years, we don't know where the technology will take us. who knows if there's going to be facial recognition software that you just kind of connect like that. We don't know. So I do, even though we do anonymous donations in that they're not to reach out to each other, you can't contract for maybe a sibling, like, you know, a cousin or somebody, and then they start connecting the dots that way.
Right. On one of these registries.
But something else, but then that is another thing too, though. So there is anonymity, and you can still have anonymity with those registries because you're identified by numbers. So you can even communicate anonymously. So that if you need additional medical information, you can get that through. There's Donor Sibling Registry. There's EDC Nexus, which is another platform, which I'm very much a fan of those things because there is information that, you know, your genetic contributor will only have that unique ability to provide.
Hmm. Well, here's another question that I have for you, Roya, that really I really was interested in. Are these sperm clinics allowed to use the same sperm to make 67 or more children? I mean, isn't there some concern that many children could meet up someday and procreate incestuously?
Yes. So there is an ASRM guideline, the American Society for Reproductive Medicine, in that there shouldn't be more than 25 families per 800,000 people.
Explain that.
So they shouldn't have more than 25 births per 800,000 people from that sperm donor.
You mean in one area?
Yeah.
800,000 people in one geographic area?
Yes.
But, you know, this is where transient society, people move all the time.
Of course.
I mean, shouldn't they put some absolute limit on how many times they can use one person's sperm?
I mean, I think they should. Do they know?
They don't.
No, with egg donors, yes, they cap it at 6 typically. Again, because that's more, it's a procedure with a retrieval. But no, the donors, there's really, really less oversight on that, especially since not all of the clinics are communicating with one another. So you could, you know, because it's not a medical procedure, you don't necessarily have a medical chart. There's not going to be a database that would share with another one. So they could donate to one cryo clinic and then they could donate to another.
Oh, yeah, that's true. There's no way of stopping them.
And then
if it's $40 a shot,
right.
You could go to several sperm banks.
Yeah,
and
you could shop it around.
Shop it around. Oh, my gosh. I mean, these are issues that, you know, the film raises, right, Matt?
Yeah, and I think an interesting thing happened when we were at a film festival a couple weeks ago in Pennsylvania. When we're there in person, and that's why I'd like to encourage everyone to come out to Sunscreen. Like, it's a real benefit to meet the filmmakers who, you know, we love talking about our projects, and it's a unique experience, and it's better than watching it on streaming when you can't talk to someone.
And better than on radio, let's face it, because we only have audio here.
I was greeting people as they were, you know, coming into the theater at this festival and saying hello, one young man introduced himself, and he was in his late teens, and he said, I'm one of Aaron's biological children.
Oh my God.
And I had, you know, and he happened to live nearby, and I wasn't aware of him yet. You know, he wasn't somebody who was in the movie, and it just shows how, yeah, you don't really know where people are and where they live. And I think if we did live in a smaller country, that would be much, much higher risk of, you know, if Aaron had 67 kids in Luxembourg, you know, there'd be more of a chance of them, you know, meeting and possibly dating each other, perhaps.
But we really don't know, though. And unless those kids who would be adults then, unless they were in some registry, you know, had made that decision themselves to look up their genetic background, they wouldn't know if the person they were dating was their half-sister or brother, right?
Yeah, and a lot of parents, you know, in like a heterosexual couple, a lot of parents don't tell their children that their donor conceived.
Oh, yeah, right.
And that's really where we get into the deception, which I'm glad that, you know, this wasn't the experience for these three people.
Yeah, that wasn't. And I think that's important. I mean, I think kids need to know, you know, their background. But there are families who don't tell their kids that they were adopted, or, you know, whether it's an egg donor or sperm donor, they may not tell them. You know, some families are weird about that.
And the the data suggests that when they do know that they're not affected, really. They're you know, on par with their peers who are not donor conceived.
You mean emotionally?
Correct.
So,
yeah.
Socially, they don't
because
freak out about
when
it.
You use a donor, you're so wanted. You know that somebody sought out to create you, so they don't have a lot of that trauma. But it's just really, I think, when parents don't tell their children their story, their birth story, that's really when there becomes issues.
Right. And then they find out either themselves by going on 23andMe or one of the other services. Then when they find out themselves, they feel deceived.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, do we have any new laws to watch out for, Roya? I mean, and how can we get a law passed about, like, how many times you can use the same sperm? I just wonder about that.
I don't even know that that's something that should be legislated. That should be a best practice with clinics, right?
Uh-huh.
Not everything needs a law.
Okay.
Would it be Florida specific? And then you'd be going to a different state, a different country. So I think it would be hard to enforce.
Yeah.
So I think really when you follow, like, ASRM guidelines at a minimum, then that, you know, that's
that would
a
solve
start.
The problem.
It wouldn't solve the problem because I understand your concern. I don't know that I definitely think it's a concern. But yeah. And
things are moving very fast.
Well, I don't want to legislate anything as it relates to IVF, which is really when you talk about these, you know, the legislative session, the last one had so many anti-IVF assisted reproductive technology bills.
Yeah. In fact, one of my listeners has just written in who says, one, he hopes to check out the film this weekend. And also he says, I was curious about whether the recent anti-LGBTQ crusade by Trump and DeSantis has made it harder for gay and lesbian couples to use sperm donation as an option for having children. I assume that would also, his question would also relate to surrogacy because, the MAGA administration seems very intolerant of gay couples.
Yes, they are. And specifically in Florida, Senator Grawl continues to propose legislation that's like, you know, anti-LGBTQ and just anti-surrogacy, anti-IVF. This personhood legislation keeps coming up. The one thing that has kind of affected it is that there was a recent Supreme Court case in Florida. It was about they used donor, but because they did it through an IUI and not like art, not with a
turkey baster.
Yes, turkey baster.
Let's be clear.
Florida law allowed for turkey baster.
How could they not allow it?
Well, a lot of states don't allow it. And when I talk to friends in this space, they're shocked. They're like, Florida's the Wild West with that. So the case.
Wait.
Yeah.
How could they prevent that?
Well, the enforcement of it, right? So if you buy sperm and then you use it but now they're saying that the reason that the donor was considered to be a parent was because they didn't use assisted reproductive technology. So they didn't do it under the practice of a doctor.
Simply put, they didn't do it in a clinic?
Correct.
But
a lot of states do require that you have clinic, and that's kind of a way that you could track it if we're talking about tracking versus legislating,
uh-huh.
Because nobody knows how many vials you're getting from California and using in your bathroom, right?
Right. So the significance of this case, Roya, is that in that case where it was a turkey baster insemination, somebody bought sperm from a clinic and did it themselves?
No,
it was like a
directed donation.
Okay,
so it
was somebody got their brother-in-law to donate or something like that, and they used a turkey baster or a syringe, and they did it in their bathroom. And in that instance, unlike if you go to a clinic, that particular donor was deemed to be a parent with parental legal responsibilities toward the child.
Correct. But one thing I couldn't actually get from it, and I've asked around, is whether or not there was an agreement in place, because we have a statute that says if there's an agreement, then they would be a donor relinquishing rights. And I couldn't get that information, but it did turn on whether or not there was art used, assisted reproductive technology.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So all you people out there who are taking your turkey basters and your brother-in-laws to the bathroom, be aware.
Go to a clinic.
Go to a clinic if the donor wants to be not a parent.
Well, it was quite the opposite. It was the donor was asserting parentage.
Oh, the donor was asserting parentage. Yeah. Okay. Well, there you go. So in Florida, this was a Florida case?
It was a Florida case, yeah.
Yeah, so in Florida, be aware of those circumstances. How interesting is that, you know? All right. So do we have any new laws we need to watch out for, Roya, in this area?
I mean, in this space, the only thing now, it's kind of pending the DeSantis' signature, is whether or not intended parents or surrogates actually from foreign countries of concern can do surrogacy in Florida. So that would be China, Venezuela, Cuba, Iran.
What does that mean, to do surrogacy in Florida?
You could engage with a surrogate in Florida to have a valid gestational surrogacy agreement. They wouldn't be allowed to do
surrogacy. Oh, so the would-be parents from a foreign country wouldn't be allowed to hire a surrogate from Florida.
And avail themselves of Florida laws, yes.
And okay. But anybody in Florida can hire a surrogate from a foreign country?
I mean, no, you shouldn't, because the idea is that surrogacy is the safest in America, so you really wouldn't want to do that abroad. There were all those cases of people doing surrogacy in Ukraine, and then a war broke out.
And they
then
couldn't
those surrogates
get their kids
were like
back.
In bunkers. It was wild.
So, okay, so your suggestion is buy American. Is
that yes.
When it comes to surrogacy and egg donation.
And something else I should say, too, a lot of, like, international laws, there's really a shift to not allowing anonymous donations. So that in most states are starting to go in that direction, too, as far as not allowing anonymous donations.
Is that because they're worried about people having adequate medical information?
No, I really think it's a movement by donor-conceived children, because they feel like that
they want to know their background.
They do. And, you know, when we talk about parents and the right to be a parent, sometimes the rights of children are overlooked. And these children, you know, they do want to know that information.
Hmm.
So, yeah. So like I said, that's a shift, but it's happening more and more in the states when they're introducing new legislation. It's in that direction.
Well, I certainly think that this film in particular would suggest that the whole idea of anonymity in this space is really,
it's not a thing.
It's gone now. Right, Matt?
Yeah. And it's interesting because you don't need to have your sperm donor on 23andMe either. In fact, we meet Aaron's cousin briefly in the film, who was also a sperm donor. And
Aaron the idea to do this?
Well, the interesting thing is Aaron didn't realize that his cousin had been a sperm donor. Aaron was contacted by somebody who connected with him genetically on 23andMe and said, "Aaron, I think you might have a brother or a cousin who's my sperm donor father."
Oh, wow.
And Aaron guessed who his family that might be, right? So Aaron's cousin wasn't on 23andMe, but this donor child was able to connect with Aaron, and then Aaron was able to make the connection. So there really isn't that anonymity. You don't have to be on 23andMe. You just have to have a relative on 23andMe. You know?
Wow. So that's the moral of the story.
And that's what we talk about in contracts. So when you talk about, you can still contract for anonymity, but I can't tell you what your cousins can't do or your brother or sister can't do, because they're not parties to the agreement.
Right, and all you need is
one genetic relative on
23andMe, and the jig is up, huh?
Can I ask you something, Matt? Who's going to be here from your film on Saturday?
I'm going to be there in person, and Craig, the director, will also be there.
Perfect. It's so great to have talent when there's a film festival.
Yeah.
We love talking to people, and I think the film raises so many questions that the discussions after the film usually go on for quite a long time, because people have so many follow-ups and want to talk about it.
Yeah, well, yeah. See, Roya, this is you're a film festival person too. So
yeah, I wish you would have submitted to GIF.
Yeah.
There's still time. We can do it. Next round, we will do it.
Maybe next year, right? Mm-hmm. Well, all right, Matt, is there anything else you want us to know about the film before we have to end?
I think people will find it, you know, there's some heavy moments in the film, and it's tender, but it's also funny at times, too. And I think people can relate to it. And please show up in person. And
yeah, that's the Sunscreen Film Festival Saturday.
Sunscreen Saturday at 3:45.
At 3:45 p.m. Okay, great. Yep. Well, that's really all we have time for, my friends. I want to thank my guest, Matt Isaac, producer of Dad Jeans, which is a fascinating documentary that we'll be showing at the Sunscreen Film Festival on Saturday, May 2nd in St. Pete at 3:45 p.m. I encourage you to check it out. And attorney Roya Barrios, thank you for being with us. Thanks for joining us on Midpoint. Thanks also to Jessica Green on the soundboard and Daria Miranova, our Midpoint show assistant. Roya, did you have anything you wanted to add quickly?
Nope. Thank you
okay.
for having me.
Now stay tuned for Talking Animals right after the NPR News, followed by Mario and Joe on The Conversation at Noon. I hope you all enjoyed tropical heat wave this weekend, our signature event here at WMNF, and we are WMNF Tampa. All around me.